I am here with Jani Glend, newly appointed Secretary General of the humanitarian NGO, the Norwegian Refugee Council, since August 2013, and former head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs from 2003 to 2006. Jan, thank you very much for being with us on the Global Observatory. You participated on a study commissioned by your own organization and OCHA on the impact of counterterrorism measures on humanitarian action. Can you tell us more on the impact of these measures?
This study is a study of experts, independent experts, that were commissioned by the United Nations and OCHA on one hand and the Norwegian Refugee Council on behalf of the NGOs on the other side, to find out what has been the real impact of counterterrorism laws on humanitarian work for the most vulnerable groups in places where there may be groups that have been designated as terrorists. And the conclusion is very clear that there has been, unfortunately, unintended consequences whereby non-governmental organizations, even UN agencies and other humanitarian organizations, have had to limit their work for needy people or have censored themselves their work, limited their work for some of the most vulnerable groups because we have been afraid of the consequences of being active in Gaza or in Somalia or other places studied here. And the unintended consequence is, as I say, civilians are suffering. I don't think the legislators wanted that. What we now ask for is a real dialogue with the good donors that want us to help the poor and the vulnerable. And this dialogue should lead to more flexible legislations and rules for organizations like my own.
Can you be a little bit more specific on the kind of impact that those counterterrorism measures have on humanitarian action? Is it like a risk of being criminally pursued for contact with terrorists, for instance?
Well, indeed, the governments want to do away with any and all contact with or assistance to terrorist groups. They have not prohibited specifically, and that's very good, us negotiating access with any and all armed actors, as we have to do, even those who are terrorists. But they have very often said that we cannot do humanitarian work that is in any way assisting these groups. So, for example, in Hamas-governed Gaza, many groups have limited their assistance to children in schools. They have limited their work for the most vulnerable of civilians. There was one case of a group who thought they could not anymore give school feeding into kindergartens because the headmasters were seen as being part of Hamas. And of course, a baby is a baby. A baby is neither left or right or Islamist or Christian. A baby has needs and those needs to be covered. In Somalia, we saw that starving people in areas controlled by Al-Shabaab were suddenly having fewer organizations and agencies working for them. And some of these groups then felt that they had to go through cumbersome procedures to be sure that aid was given according to criteria, which made it more difficult to do relief. And starving people, again, should be given food aid and other aid flexibly, easily, according to needs, whether or not they're under a bad de facto ruler. And my own organization is today having to turn away money we really need for water and sanitation projects in the biggest refugee camp on Earth, which is a Dadaab camp for Somali refugees in Kenya, because we've asked by a donor, which is a very good donor in general, to do something bad, which is to hand over bio data on all of the staff involved in this project and all of our partners and contacts in this project, so that they, this Western donor, can vet these people. That is prohibited by our board. We cannot do that. We have to avoid being seen as an instrument for any political or other actor in this world, and especially in a sensitive place like the Somali refugee programs.
What are the main recommendations coming out of this study in order to alleviate the negative impact of those measures?
The main and overriding recommendation among many is, of course, let's sit down and talk. The donors want to help us help the most needy people on Earth. They never wanted it to make it difficult for us to help these people. There was never the intention of the parliamentarians or the congressmen and women who enacted these laws in the first place. And we, on our side, we want to make sure to the donors and to the world that, of course, we have many procedures that make it impossible for us to in any way assist any political or armed actor. That's contrary to every fiber in our humanitarian body. We have a lot of safeguards. So by sitting down, I think we can alleviate the fears of each and every government and donor assisting us, and we can then get them to understand and to agree that it was never the purpose to make it difficult to dig latrines for refugees by having a counter-terrorism legislation.
Despite these safeguards, diversion of aid is also a reality in a number of very complicated, insecure places, like in Somalia, for instance. Do you think that humanitarians can do better to alleviate those legitimate fears of some governments that aid might be diverted and go in the pockets of a designated terrorist group?
Of course, that's always difficult in a chaotic, war-torn place to monitor all assistance, always. If we want now to assist inside Syria as we should, of course, it's not easy to follow every food parcel to the kitchen table of every single family. But number one, we're never sending money to any political or armed actor, period. Our other partners are the groups that we know have a good track record, that will bring the resources to those with greatest needs. We have all sorts of safeguards for that. But then again, it is impossible to control everything and anything. It's even very difficult in a normal government that has social welfare programs to monitor every single payment to every single person. In this case, however, let's be aware that we're giving out blankets, we're giving out baby food, we're giving out medical relief. We're not into any of the things that these armed actors need to undertake their horrific violence or terrorist activities.
For my last question, I would like to take a step back and reflect with you on some of your achievements as Emergency Relief Coordinator and head of OCHA from 2003 to 2006. Back then, you introduced the so-called humanitarian reform, which aimed at strengthening the leadership, the coordination, and the funding of humanitarian aid. This reform had many benefits to improve the predictability of the humanitarian response, but also had the effect of further centralizing humanitarian aid under United Nations umbrella. Isn't it on a collision course with increased integration of UN peacekeeping and political missions that brings all UN activities, including humanitarian aid, under the political leadership of the mission? And more concretely, what's your organization's position to maintain its independence in countries like Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, or Somalia, where the humanitarian coordinator happens to be also the deputy head of a political UN mission.
It's true that in my time as Emergency Relief Coordinator and Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs from 2003 to 2006, I saw the need for a reform of the humanitarian system. We had problems responding well enough in Darfur in particular, which was the exploding crisis at the time. There was not enough predictable money. We often had neglected emergencies when no donor money came. And we also had not predictable enough personnel nor material resources for big operations. We also did not have enough predictable leadership to send in the field. All of these things were then addressed in the humanitarian reform. We got a bigger and better central emergency response fund. We said we needed clusters of organizations working together in each and every area where we had gaps, like water and sanitation, like emergency education, like logistics, etc. And all of this was not leading to more centralization in the UN. It was rather enabling a humanitarian community with NGOs and UN agencies to work together. So in the clusters, it was very clear that they could be co-led by non-governmental organizations. It was opening up the whole leadership more to non-governmental organizations. The problem of having integrated political, military, and humanitarian and developmental missions was sort of a parallel process led by the Secretary General and the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, Department of Political Affairs. And here I was torn as a humanitarian. On one hand, I welcomed that the UN could really build a state, build a nation, end war, build peace in a coherent manner. But as humanitarians, yes, we need to make very sure of our independence, our neutrality, our impartiality from political and military actors. That is also why we launched now this study on the negative effects of counter-terrorism legislation in donor monies. We need to maintain our independence and neutrality. And I think we can and we should do that at the same time as we, among ourselves, coordinate better, become more robust in helping defend the rights of vulnerable people.
Jan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.